human relations and curriculum change. We've come through problem solving and what change is all about. Now we want to talk about the role of the facilitator. We have said that change agents need a social engineering theory which provides conceptual tools for diagnosing the possibilities for change, for locating the forces which support it, and for devising change procedures for those which oppose it. You see, human relations and curriculum change is a procedure for changing society, for changing the social dynamics of the group, but they have procedures for you who oppose it. In the last few years, there's been accumulating a small but growing body of investigations and writing in the fields of human engineering, quote unquote, and group development. These investigations and writings attempt to focus the resources of various social sciences, including psychology, upon the problems of inducing and controlling changes in the social systems. They're talking social systems language. How do I get into that social system, whatever it is, your organization, your Bible study group, whatever it is, how do I get in there as a change agent? I need to identify, I need to have a method to do that. Ronald Havelock, he came along a little bit later and refined this very narrow concept. And this is a change agent's guide to innovation in education. At the top it says, education the way it is now. And then there's a bunch of steps, I won't detail those. And then at the bottom it says, education the way we would like to see it in the future. You see the dialectic there. The way it is, the way it ought to be. This is a change agent's guide. Change agent looks at that and goes, I see the way it is. I'm going to go in and help you get it the way it ought to be, the way it should be. Here in the center is the client system, it says. Think of that as you, or whatever organization or group that you happen to be in. There are four different roles of the change agent. I'll just describe the first one there on the upper left. It is the change agent as a catalyst. The change agent that comes in, you know what a catalyst does in chemistry? It binds two ingredients together, whether they like it or not. That's what a catalyst does. And labeled on that arrow entering the system is pressure to change. And the first step in that process of the arrows that go in a circle is disturbance. So the change agent goes in there and pressures the system to change. He creates a disturbance. This is the role of a revolutionary. A Marxist goes in and creates disturbance. And then there's process helper, solution giver, and resource linker down there below. But again, this is a system. It's an isolated system, but now the change agent comes in from without or from within. The change agent client system is also the therapist patient. Here's another depiction here on the right is the internal problem-solving cycle. This is the victim. I call him the victim. The client is over here and he's got whatever problem it is. He goes through this process. He feeds back to the change agent. The change agent comes up with solutions and feeds back. And then how did the solution work? It's this constant feedback loop. It is a systems dynamic model. Also very dialectic. Okay, this one gives me the chills. Here's the relationship between the client system and the change agent. In the dark circle, it says client, but then in the dotted circles, within the larger bounded one, is the church and business and the Board of Education and the family. Basically everybody that's going to be involved in the community. No one's excluded from this. If you try, you're the enemy of the system. You're deviating. This one shows how change agents go from one system to the next. I come in, the change agent on the left, I influence one particular person and he influences five. It's like a virus. You see how this is just like spreading like a virus. Networking of the 70s and 80s, that's what this was all about. Network, 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 network. Propagate the process. Send people away to training, bring them back into the organizations. They are now change agents. He says a change agent should know about the process of change, how it takes place, and the attitudes, values, and behaviors that usually act as barriers. See, a change agent has to go in and identify who the resistors are. He should know who in his system are the defenders or the resistors of innovations. That's another way to change the language. Innovations, that's change. Are you opposed to my innovation? It sounds like you're being negative, right? And innovation sounds positive. If you're opposed to that, you're a resistor to innovation. All of this is sorcery. This is witchcraft. It's nothing but Baalism. This is what shocks me, is that most Christians, I'm assuming that I'm speaking predominantly to a Christian audience, Now, if I say this is witchcraft, the sad thing is that most Christians don't know church history, they don't know Gnosticism, they don't know the ancient mysteries, they don't know the ABCs of magic. So if I said this is witchcraft, I go, I never saw anybody come in with one of those wizard hats and a wand and a cape and flying in on a broom. See, again, it's like Marx says, you have certain conceptions of what sorcery is. Let me tell you what the basics of sorcery and magic is. It's two things. It's the utilization of your imagination. Did you know that? Did you know that as the fundamental property of magic and sorcery and witchcraft? The second is word power or language. Casting spells is the most obvious one, but language utilizes. So your mind power and word power is the key to magic. But see, I can use other language. I can come into the room with a three-piece suit and be a sorcerer. And I can get everybody together in a diverse group and dialogue to consensus. And you don't even know I'm practicing magic. Because that's the goal of magic, is to manipulate the forces of the unseen world. Magic can be defined, as out of the encyclopedia, a system of beliefs and practices by which it is believed that man may control the natural and supernatural forces that affect his life. Okay, well, how does he do that? Imagination, mind power techniques, and word power techniques. These are all occultists. Most of them are. There's one in here, I think, is just an occult investigator. Prominent, very prominent people. These are just an easy sampling. It didn't take me long to find these. The Magical Arts by Richard Cavendish. Concentration and imagination are vitally important in magic. McGregor Mathers. This is one of the founders of the Order of the Golden Dawn, an occult group at the turn of the century. To practice magic, both the imagination and the will must be called into action. See, they're instructing adepts into how to do. These are advanced arts of magic and the occult. The real heart of magical training, according to James Webb, is systematic visualization. The heart of magical training. Not black cats, not lizard tails. You know, and that sort of, it's imagination, visualization. The developing practitioner of advanced magical arts must have grounding and experience in the following disciplines: meditation, concentration, visualization, and ritual pattern making. Occultist R.J. Stewart. Colin Wilson in The Mysteries. This notion of the magical power of the imagination is not confined to the Western tradition, no duh. It can be found all over the world. It started in Babel and spread all over the world at the dispersion. The clue to all this esoteric work, according to Alice Bailey, demanded by Shambhala, is to be found in the development of the art of visualization. Now, Alice Bailey headed up Lucifer Trust, now called Lucis Trust. This is what her spirit guide told her. All this stuff, all this occult work demanded by Shambhala. Shambhala is the mystical place where the ascended master supposedly live, the one that was talking to her. He says the clue to it all is systematic visualization, the use of your imagination. By the way, Lucis Trust is the only official religious organization of the United Nations, and they manage the meditation center in New York in the United Nations, where you can go and visualize world peace. You know that bumper sticker, visualize world peace? That is a call to occultic, that's a magical call to use your imagination, word power, to globalize the world. That's a magic, that's a sorcerer's invocation. Visualize world peace. That's not just a happy sentiment. In the mind's eye, it is the doorway to altered states of consciousness. And this is where all interaction with the demonic realm takes place, in altered states of consciousness. And it begins with the imagination. It's the instrument for the manipulation and recreation of consciousness. That's what psychotherapy is. The Structure of Magic by John Grinder and Richard Bandler. The Structure of Magic. And on the cover, can you see it? There's this wizard and he's got his cap and wand and all that stuff. And wow, what is this about? It's hypnosis. These John Grinder and Richard Bandler are the leading hypnotherapists in the world today. These are the guys that teach you about neurolinguistics programming, the most powerful form of hypnosis. And it's all language. You open up the book, it's not magical formulas and stuff. It's how to use language to create transformation. And they know, they're telling you, these guys are just clinical psychologists that are experts in language structure. And they're calling it the Structure of Magic. And it's not just a cute ha-ha-ha thing. They mean it. And the subtitle is a book about communication or language and change. Marx said we got to change the world. It's sorcery. They said elsewhere, stopping the intern, this is from a poem of a sorcerer in the middle of one of his other books. This is what he says. Stopping the internal dialogue is, however, the key to the sorcerer's world. What internal dialogue? Can you think of Freud? You can think of Kurt Lewin and J.L. Marino and all these guys that are the conflict, play behavior, barrier behavior, the id, the superego, your conscience, the feelings. The sorcerer, Satan, the original sorcerer, took Eve through that magical experience into the realm of the imagination. Did she become like God? No, only in the realm of her imagination did she. In reality, her eyes were opened, and she knew she was naked. That's all she got out of the pie. The rest of the activities are only props. All they do is accelerate the effect of stopping the internal dialogue. The imagination, mind power, and word power. It's sorcery. I've tried to illustrate this as simply as possible. Within this bounded circle, we have is. We have facts. It's reality. It's the way things are. Outside the circle, outside of reality, there are the can-bes. We can be, whatever's possible. And we have ought-to-bes outside that circle. If it's real, it can't be an ought-to-be. It can't be a can-be, because it's an is. So where can the can-bes and the ought-to-bes flourish? This is the ABCs of sorcery. It's in the realm of the imagination. You can only imagine what can be, and you can only imagine what ought to be. So when a change agent comes in and says, you know, it can be different. It ought to be different. That's the language of sorcery. And most people, they don't even get it. It's very important to understand that this is a boundary. There is a boundary between what is and what isn't, or what is in your imagination. You have to cross the boundaries. You have to cross borders. You have to get around that barrier to get into the realm of your imagination. And it's just the realm of seems to be. And this is the dialectic process. Human relations and curriculum change. Let's go back to that. Only a method, he's talking about change agents, only a method of such scope can deal with the problem of changing human relations. For inevitably, it must consider not only what is and what can be, but also what ought to be. It's the language of the sorcerer. And I can't help but note the irony. They developed the national training laboratories where you do experiments. It's just where you have hypothesis. It's just theory. You're just in the realm of the imagination. And you get the group to arrive at seems to be, not is, seems to be. This is the work of the magician. And then, of course, the dialectic process. Is, can be, and synthesized to ought to be, or in the realm of seems to be. Here's some examples that I just picked just out of the last few weeks, just to illustrate this. I got this fold out with my National Geographic. It's a Ford commercial. It's a Ford ad, I should say. Along the border, there's all of these words. And they're just advertising an expedition. They got a climbing team there to, you know, sponsor their deal here. And it says, what's in your heart? What's stopping you? Note the language. Would you like to go beyond? Beyond what? We're advertising a car here. Where does your soul pull you? No boundaries. Can you imagine? This is sorcerer's language. And of course, Ford, that's their new buzz now. No boundaries. We're talking about a car, for crying out loud. No boundaries? What are they trying to do? Of course, they're trying to sell you a car. They don't want any boundaries between you and their product. But I guarantee you, the person that cooked up that ad knows the structure of magic, because they're using the language. They're taking you through therapy in an ad. The media does this all the time. An ad can be a change agent. You flip that page open, you're in therapy. Turn it again. You're going through therapy. Turn on the news. Bam, bam, bam. Here's another one. I just found this one. I found this one in a matchbox. This is Winston cigarettes. No boundaries, no bull. No boundaries. Cigarettes, no boundaries. Yeah, no. Don't hold back. Go beyond. Get around the barrier. No boundaries. Come on, smoke that cigarette. No big deal. It's sorcerer's language. And they know that. Advertisers know this. And they're trying to sell a product, granted. But it's they're experts in psychotherapy, is what they are. You go to advertising school, you learn this inside and out. Okay, here's Takiza beer. I buy it for the centerfold, the main print says. Ha 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 ha, right? Very bold statement. Feels good to say what you really think, huh? It feels good, doesn't it, to say what you really think, huh? It's only for those who hold nothing back. Speak your mind. This is the buzz for Tequiza beer. Speak your mind, drink your beer. Speak your mind. Don't hold anything back. Wouldn't you like to? I do that too much. My foot ends up in my mouth too much. Speak your mind. Don't speak your mind. God says, hold your tongue. Drink your beer. That's the connection. Just, hey, I'll drink whatever I want. No boundaries. And of course, the catch buzz at the very bottom is beer without borders. Beer without borders? You see this constant, it's a theme. It's everywhere you go. You are in therapy. Beer without borders. Here's the Hummer. Here's another advertisement. Here's the Hummer about ready to run you over in the ad. And it says in the middle, if you can, maybe you will. It's an ambiguous statement. Of course, you connect it with the car. Well, if I can, in other words, if I can buy it, if I can drive it somewhere, maybe I will. Maybe I'll go off-roading or something. But it's psychological. It's psychotherapy. If you can, don't stay where you are. Go if you can. Maybe you will. This is Satan's language. He said this to Eve. If you can, maybe you will. Maybe you should. You ought to. Take that fruit. Nike, how about that? Just do it. Just do it. What are they telling you? Just do it. You guys lived through the 60s, most of you, I take it? What's the other half of that phrase? What comes before that? Famous saying from the 1960s. If it feels good, just do it. You know where that phrase came from? You know who coined that term? Herbert Marcuse of the Frankfurt School. Eros and Civilization. That was his whole, I mean, that's the thrust. The Dionysian personality. You find your potential in excess. If it feels good, just do it. Nike just picked it up and said, just do it. That's an advertising slogan now. Just do it. Come on, Eve, Adam, just do it. Just do it. Don't hold back. Those are examples of change agents. This all harkens back to the ancient mysteries. It harkens back to the great enemy of the early church, which was Gnosticism. And it's unfortunate that most pastors today, will show me a pastor today that will instruct his congregation, instruct his people in what Gnosticism really is. And unfortunately, it's a hideously complex mythological system, but it has a structure to it. Can't even begin to introduce you. You'll have to do your own homework on what Gnosticism is. But it inherited its concepts from the mystery religions, which were all astral-based, the sun, the moon, and the stars. What does that have to do with what we're talking about? The path of the sun. The path of the sun goes through the day. It rises, goes across, and sets. And it goes through this night journey, according to the ancients, according to Babylonian mythology. It goes down through the netherworld, the underworld. The sun goes through its journey. And the sun was deified. When Nimrod died, it was said that his soul occupied the place of the sun. His wife, Semiramis, when she passed away, her soul ascended and inhabited the moon. She became the goddess of the moon, the queen of heaven. And of course, before she passed away, the spirit from the sun came down and let there be light and cohabited with her, and she bore a son called Tammuz. And he was the resurrection of Nimrod. He was associated with this planet Venus, and he was the bright and morning star. So you had the sun, the moon, and the stars. Israel got in trouble. They were known in Canaan as Baal. That was the solar deity. It was just Nimrod moved into Canaan. The Ashtoreth was the queen of heaven. She was associated with the moon. And Tammuz, there was no name change there. They got in trouble. Read Jeremiah chapter 8. They got in trouble for worshiping Tammuz. They were led into idolatry by Solomon when he married all of his wives. It was this basic cosmological cycle. And associated with that, of course, you have the sun. When it set, it was equated with death. And when it rose, it was rebirth. This was a cyclical process of birth, death, rebirth. You think evolution started with Darwin? No, it started at the Tower of Babel and before that. It's a very dialectic system. And witchcraft, they still practice. This is the essence of witchcraft. They say it's a fertility. You know, modern witchcraft is just a little, it's like a fertility cult. No. The wizard, the grand witch, is seen as Baal. And he, in the grand magic ritual, he has a magical sexual rite with the witch. And that is the sun and the moon, the marriage of King Sol and the queen moon. And that is very dialectic. Again, the sun and the moon, night, dark. The structure has been carried from the ancient mysteries. And the great alchemical statement, as above, so as below. You can't understand what is light unless you understand darkness. You can't understand yin without yang. This is very ancient. And by the time of Christ, and the apostles were dealing with this in the form of Gnosticism. The ancient mythological world was crumbling in the Roman Empire. And as people searched for meaning in their lives, they reshuffled the same basic structure, and no longer was it, you know, the kings that were deified and associated with the sun and the moon and the stars. Now the average Joe on the street could have it too. And Gnosticism, they Christianized this system. They overlaid it with Christian terminology. And you have this concept, and I put God in quotation marks, because he's the God above all. That is the solar deity. And way down below in the material universe is man. And he's separated from this source, his true source of being. He is alienated from his true source of being. But because he's trapped in this material universe, he is unaware of his hidden connection with God. This is the New Age movement, the God within. Remember Marilyn Ferguson in The Aquarian Conspiracy? She's talking about the God within. That's what the Gnostics were all about. The Gnostic says, you don't have to believe in Christ, you can be a Christ. And we wouldn't know about most of the early church fathers had they not gone after this system. Irenaeus wrote a volume against heresies, and he took from Timothy. Against heresies, he wrote against so-called science, which was Gnosticism. So what's the cure for the Gnostic? What is salvation in the Gnostic system? It is gnosis. That's where the word Gnostic comes from. What does it mean? It's Greek for knowledge. Knowledge of what? Knowledge of your inner divinity. Of course, they don't tell you that right up front. It's an initiation process. But again, there's this dualistic nature that they must synthesize God and man. Now, with the triumph of Christianity, all this stuff became suppressed for several centuries. And of course, the church went after this with a vengeance, trying to stamp this stuff out. But it survived in Arabia. With the onset of Islam, it was reintroduced into Europe in the form of the Jewish Kabbalah, in Gnosticism, the Neo-Gnosticism, and the philosophers of the Romantic and the Enlightenment period drew heavily on this period. When the Renaissance came about, what were they renaissancing? The Greco-Roman era and all of its pagan roots. So all this stuff came back into Europe, and then it went to war. We are now at the peak. We're at the curl of that wave, of this reintroduction of Gnostic thinking. This fellow right here is Jacob Boehm. There's a long daisy chain of people and personalities along the way. He stands as an intermediary link between ancient Gnosticism and today's Marxism, Hegel, and the psychoanalytic movement. Why? What was he doing? Again, all of his works are very complicated. If I threw up quotes, you'd nod off. It's hard to read. He illustrated his works, and here's one of his illustrations. I'll just give you one. If you can see, it's very rich in symbols and artwork, but if you notice that you've got the upper realm of light, and this is where, you know, you've got light and purity and God and everything is dwelling up here. But down below is this also this realm of darkness, and there's demons and things seething around underneath here. This is Jacob Boehm in his, they call him a Christian mystic, but he was nothing of the kind. He was an occultic, he was a Gnostic. And in the center, you have a synthesis of both light and darkness. If you could see in the middle there, it's still carrying these remnants of ancient mythology. There's the sun and the moon and the stars. All the astrological stuff is still there. The reason I just bring you up to Jacob Boehm is because Hegel drew very heavily from Jacob Boehm. He read him very thoroughly, and you can go to his Philosophy of History and read what he has to say. It's pure dialectic. And all Hegel did was strip all of this ancient mystery religion and Gnostic structure of its outer trappings and was just left with the kernel. It was just left with this dialectic concept. Three things: thesis, antithesis, synthesis. And you wouldn't recognize it as what came out of Babylon, but that's what it is. In Life Against Death by Norman Brown, there's, again, just the title of the book, Life Against Death, it's dialectic. Against, even the word, life against death. Speaking of Boehm, he says, what he's doing, he's tying Marx and Freud together. in his book, Life Against Death. And it's probably one of the better explanations on Freud. It helped me understand Freud, his system, more than anything else. Norman Brown was educated in the tradition of the German occultists and the German philosophers, so he knows what he's talking about. In the 60s, there was a couple people, Herbert Marcuse, who I mentioned earlier, and his Eros and Civilization, and Life Against Death, Norman Brown. You weren't with it in the 60s on any campus in America if you hadn't read Norman Brown or Herbert Marcuse. You were out of the loop. You weren't cool, you weren't hip. But he's speaking of Bohm in here towards the end of the book, and he says, backwards, he is linked through Paracelsus, another famous German occultist, and alchemy to the tradition of Jewish Gnosticism and Jewish Kabbalism. Forward, he is linked through his influence on the Romantics, Blake, Novalis, and Hegel, with Freud. So he, Norman Brown, who's an expert in this stuff, he is saying that from Freud, back through Hegel, back through the Romantic philosophers, to Jacob Bohm, to Paracelsus, back to Jewish Gnosticism, he says there's been a common thread that has wound their way all the way up to the present day. So seen, psychoanalysis is the heir to a mystical tradition which it must affirm. Do you understand that? Psychoanalysis, psychology, social psychology, is the heir to a mystical tradition which it must affirm. It's not a science. It's a religion. It's a religion of humanism. It's a religion of Baal. It's a religion of sorcery. Psychoanalysis, mysticism, poetry. Why does he say poetry? Funny, why would he throw poetry? Because the Romantic poets, Blake and Novalis and others, you read them. I mean, you go and you read the classics of poetry. You're reading sorcery. You know why? Because the poets fancy themselves as magicians, because they can compose these words and take the reader in a magical journey of transformation through their poetry. The poets. You wouldn't normally think of a poet as a sorcerer, but that's what they were. Psychoanalysis, mysticism, poetry, and the philosophy of organisms. The philosophy of organism, that's general systems theory. Goes back to Alfred North Whitehead. Feuerbach, that's what Marx drew on again, and Marx. This is just a miscellaneous assemblage. Common to all of them is a mode of consciousness that can be called the dialectical imagination. Thank you, Norman Brown. The dialectical imagination. And of course, he coined this term, Norman Brown, about 15 years later. Martin Jay, professor out of Berkeley, picks up the term and uses it for his title, The Dialectical Imagination. It's a history of the Frankfurt School. The dialectical imagination is the essence of witchcraft. It's the essence of sorcery. The philosophy of Hegel, and this is by Harvard professor Carl Friedrich, communism and fascism, pragmatism and existentialism, to name only the most outstanding movements in politics and philosophy, are incomprehensible without Hegel's philosophy. I would agree with him. I don't know how you can begin to understand communism or Marx or fascism. He throws fascism in here. You know, you go to those political classes and they put communism way over here on this end of the line, and on this end of the spectrum, they've got fascism. Carl Friedrich puts them in the same category, way over here. Because Hitler was just as Hegelian as Marx was. But his concept of the revolutionary principle in society wasn't the economic model. Marx pitted the capitalist with the proletariat, the rich guy and the poor guy. He made it an economic clash. Hitler simply said, nah, that's not the revolutionary principle. It's the Aryans and the Jews. He made it a racial conflict. It was just as Hegelian. It was just as dialectic. And they both ended in mass death. This process always ends up in death. It promises you life, just like Satan did in the garden, and it delivers death. And again, it's incomprehensible without Hegel's philosophy, which is the dialectic, and I would only add to that, Hegel is only comprehensible if you understand Gnosticism and the mystery religions. Contemporary social science, he continues, especially in America, bears the impact of Hegelian thinking to an extraordinary degree. Cultural anthropology and social psychology, it's all there, especially of the psychoanalytic and Gestalt variety. And much of the present day sociology are more Hegelian than they would like to admit or do acknowledge. Don't argue with me. I'm not making any of this stuff up. Go argue with the Harvard idea of systems thinking to practically every social avenue we can think of. A shorthand term for this process is feedback, a term borrowed originally from the electrical engineers that describe messages about deviations from a desired goal. This is no accident, because Lewin, who popularized this phrase for the behavioral sciences, was teaching at MIT during this period of time. So he just absorbed this idea from Norbert Wiener and others in the electrical engineering department. I guess he was having a bratwurst or something with the guys going, hey, what's going on today? Well, I'm fixing missiles. Hey, what idea do you got? Hey, I can apply that to people. Well, where does this come into police department stuff? This is the earliest attempt I've seen to bring all this philosophy into the realm of police work, which is why I'm here, is to relate this to police work. Thought I'd never get there, huh? This is by Weisbord, Lamb, and Drexler. Improving police department management through problem-solving task forces. Does that jump off the page at you now that you understand the background? Improving, that's like innovations. That's a nice word for changing police department management. But we're going to improve it. And if you oppose the system, you're opposed to improvement. Through problem-solving task forces or groups. A task force is a Soviet. Is it any surprise? No, because these guys were associated with the National Training Labs, and it's a case study on how they went in, and they didn't name the police department. It's an East Coast police department back in the 60s. This was written in the early 1970s. Here is problem-oriented policing. This is a manual written by Herman Goldstein. He gets standing ovations when you go to his seminars, problem-oriented policing. There's another one coming up in San Diego in September. He popularized problem-oriented policing using what he calls the SARA model, another acronym. Let's take a look at what that is. Here's my training guide for problem-oriented policing for the San Diego Police Department. The problem-solving model, community-oriented policing, SARA. There it is, SARA. It says scanning, analysis, response, and assessment. So I go in and I find out what, I scan, I identify a problem. I analyze, what kind of things can I do to help this? I have a response, and then I assess the response. Well, let's look at it overlaid with this. Here's Herman Goldstein and my training guide. It's scan, an analyze, response, and assess. The problem-solving method is nothing more than Kurt Lewin's adaptation of general systems theory to group dynamics. There's hardly a cop in the world that knows the roots of this thing. Because everybody, and cops are no different than anybody else. Yeah, they want to go jet skiing on the weekend and polish the car and water the lawn and do, they don't want to read this stuff. I torture myself with this stuff. I just read through mountains of books. I had to, because I hated this stuff. They introduced it and you want to know where my career is? It's going nowhere. Because I oppose all of this junk. I hate it. But it drove me to study the roots of it. Let's return to this definition I gave you in the very beginning. It is a shift in philosophy about police duties versus community responsibilities. See the dialectic relationship there that they are imposing. Police versus the community. That's a shift, it's a change, it's a paradigm shift to a team concept of total quality management. TQM is cybernetic control of the community. This is Marxism, transformational Marxism, for your community. $10 billion worth of it, and counting. Re-identifying the role of the police officer as a facilitator in the community. Now you know what a facilitator is, a change agent. First of all, we had to transform every police organization using these techniques, and then, once we have done that, we now train the individual officers to go into the community as change agents. You have to be exaggerating, Phil. No, I'm not. Do the officers know this? No. They do this because, just like everybody else, they're afraid to lose their jobs. The next hottest thing, they go to the training. When you go in for your sergeant's interview, your lieutenant's interview, when you want to get promoted, they ask you, what have you done? Give me some examples of some pop projects you've done. Some successful. Well, I don't do it. Why not? Because I hate it. Well, you're not getting promoted. So they play the game. Everybody plays the game because they're afraid. What about facilitators? Let's go back to George Lukacs. It's actually Norman Levine, but he's commenting on Lukacs' work here. He says, the institutions in socialist society, which act as the facilitators between the public and the private realms, are the Soviets. The facilitators between the public and the private realm. A police officer is a facilitator between the public and the private realm. Your community-oriented police officer that's trained as a facilitator comes in, he is creating a Soviet in your neighborhood. And then the very next sentence, they, who are they? They are the Soviets, are the congresses, the diverse groups, which facilitate the debate, they dialogue to consensus, of universal problems, that's common social problems, in the context of the everyday, school, work, politics, media, everything. Your police officer is coming in and getting together in a Soviet, in a diverse group, dialoguing in consensus over common social problems. That's problem solving in the context of the everyday. What problems are in your neighborhood? You got a gang problem? You got a truancy problem? You got a crosswalk problem? You got graffiti, drugs on the corner? Whatever. You know, we'll come in, we'll get all the members of the community together, and we'll dialogue over the whole thing. While everybody's focused on that issue, we're processing your conscience right out of you. And there they are. First group, dialoguing in consensus. It's a Soviet. And they do it to us. Not only are we doing it to the community, but they do it to us constantly. So I'm a detective in the domestic violence unit. We're moving to a new facility. Do they just appoint a couple experts that are really good at organizing stuff and getting chairs and desks and, you know, getting parking at the new facility? Do they do all that? No. They got to get us all in one of those things, those little circle groups, and we got to talk about, well, what do you think about where the parking should be? How wide should the parking spaces be? You know, this stuff is maddening, and we got to do it all the time. And meanwhile, my caseload is stacking and stacking and stacking. We're more concerned with diversity and doing the process than we are actually fighting crime, putting crooks in jail, and that sort of thing. Continuing the definition, leaders of the community. Here they are. Law enforcement, government, business, education, health, on and on and on. Collaborating to identify problems in the community, suggesting problems to those. So here they all are. It's the Soviet. It's your schoolroom, town council, and it's the United Nations. It's from local all the way up to the global. They've been very successful, wouldn't you say? It's everywhere. Identifying common ground. That's the consensus process, where all factions of the community can work together for the common good. That's the ever-present ideal in communist society, the common good of the community in a broader problem-solving approach. That's my problem-oriented policing. Forming a partnership between the police and the rest of the community, where each is accountable to each other and the community as a whole. Do you think that partnership is, you see, we're all accountable to each other. In this process, no one is accountable to anybody. If that group, if a police officer goes into your community and says, hey, you know, I need to talk to the business owners in this neighborhood, I need to talk to all the moms, I need to talk to all the, what they call the stakeholders, right? And I get them together in this group, and they come up with a decision out of that group, the rest of the community, that group is not accountable to them. Do you understand? They were not elected. You can point your fingers at whoever, and they go, oh, we just did it in a group. We all came to the same decision. There's not one person. You see, an elected official, they call that the democratic process. And our founders were horrified of a pure democracy. We have a representative republic. We elect a representative and you send him to represent your position. And if he does what you don't like and starts compromising your position, you elect somebody else. They are accountable to you. In this process, it's a lie. There is no accountability in the system. These convictions, I'm going to repeat myself, these convictions led Lewin to emphasize action resource problem solving as a strategy of changing and participation in groups as a medium of re-education. When a police officer comes in and does the problem solving process with you, you are not solving problems, we are solving you. You are the problem in the community. And if you deviate, who's there to watch? Everybody else in the group. Again, if we synthesize the public and the private realm, we form a partnership, what have we done? We've just gone back to community, communism, with unity for the common good. Do you see the language? This is federally funded, federally printed Department of Justice materials. And people just see it, and it sounds good. You know, they can sugarcoat it. It all sounds so good. And it gets right by. The communists are not coming over the hill. We are them. We're doing this. James Madison, those who overleap the great barrier which defends the rights of the people are tyrants. I went back after reevaluating all this dialectic process. I thought I understood the founders. I had no idea what geniuses these men were. They understood this process. Thomas Jefferson was a Gnostic. I'm not so fond of Thomas Jefferson anymore. My apologies if you're a Thomas Jefferson fan. But he was, you know, learning from the French Revolution. The French Revolution was this process, by the way. And it led to the guillotine, not to peace and security. What's the great barrier? It's our documents. The Declaration of Independence, the Bill of Rights, the Constitution. Those are the barriers. Those are the cannots. Those are the restraints. Congress shall not infringe. Those things, they're limits. And this system overleaps the barrier, or those documents which restrain the public realm, which has the power of the sword. They've got the military. Those are the police. Those are the people with the guns. They kick in your doors and stuff like that. That restrains the power. And then they, in that public realm, they went, you know, we can't trust humans. French Revolution says, yeah, man is good. Let's trust him. Let's empower the Soviet. Let's empower the group, the directorate. And they came and they brought the guillotine to the private sector. And they said, no. Mankind is bad, our founder said. And they said, we don't trust them. Let's break up the powers of government. Let's put the judiciary over here and the executive over here and you know, the other guys over there. And we're going to break them up and stay apart. And the rules are the rules. And why? To protect the private sector. He says, those who overleap that are tyrants. When we are in the process of forming a public-private partnership, we are creating a Soviet. We are putting a knife to our own throats when we do this. Here's some of the places that I received training at, real nice, posh places, Lake Arrowhead and the Hilton Harbor Island, the Wyndham Hotel in Palm Springs. This is where, big money, they don't send us to the hotel, Motel 6. Some of the training, basic facilitation skills for law enforcement. Okay, they're going to teach us how to be facilitators. This was at the RCPI, Regional Community Policing Institute in San Diego. Let's take a look and compare with human relations and my training. This is from the growth of a group. It says the group goes through four steps. In light of what happened in these eight groups at the National Training Labs, a group may perhaps be seen as going through four phases as it grows in ability to operate efficiently. In the first phase, various members of the group quickly attempt to establish their customary places in the leadership hierarchy. Let me explain what that means. We get together and we want to solve a problem. Let's say there's a leak in the roof. Automatically, without even thinking about it, we would kind of, one guy, hey, I'm a contractor. I know how to do this. I can get a crew together. And one guy says, well, I got a hardware shop. I can get the materials for it. And there are certain people that emerge as leaders, and there are other people that are followers. And everybody kind of just, there's a leadership hierarchy that forms in a group. That's the way people, and we're all different. We all have different personalities, leaders and followers and stuff. They say the first stage is that happens. The second phase, next comes a period of frustration. Ooh. Frustration, cognitive dissonance, and conflict brought about by who? The leader's steadfast rejection of the concept of peck order. That's the facilitator's role. Don't let that happen in the group. Don't let someone assert themselves as a leader. And it frustrates the group because what are we doing here? Will somebody take charge? And if somebody says, hey, I got a solution to this problem. I know how to fix this. The facilitator will shut them up. There's many ways. Remember those guys studying all the ways to neutralize those elements? He says, thank you, that's a really good idea, but we haven't heard from Mary back here. Would you know what? Shuts him up. Frustrate the group in its development to solve this thing. The third phase sees the group development of cohesiveness among the group members, accompanied by a certain amount of complacency and smugness. So in other words, they regress. I get frustrated. I can't stay in that zone of frustration. Remember Kurt Lewin and his cognitive? I can't stay in that zone. I want to solve that the need of anxiety. And so I regress. I just accept, I'm just, whatever. I'm part of the group now. I'm not even going to try anymore. And then the fourth group, now in the fourth phase, the members retain a group-centeredness. It's no longer individual-centered. It's group-centered. And the sensitivities which characterize the third phase, but they develop also a sense of purpose. So now I got a group that's worth something. I got a group. I don't have potatoes in a sack. I've got a sack of potatoes. Okay, from my training, stages of group development. It begins lower right-hand corner, and it proceeds counterclockwise. Four steps. What a coincidence. It's got these cartoon figures, and they're coming up to water's edge. They've got their shoes off, and they're kind of dipping their toes. I guess cops are too stupid to understand just plain English, so we got to have cartoon version to explain how this works. And it's got form, storm, norm, and perform. Isn't that cute? They all kind of rhymes. And the first group is forming, right? That's where they form together, the hierarchical group. And then they storm. There's this period of frustration that this book describes. This is facilitation for skills for law enforcement. It's straight out of human relations and curriculum change. Then you've got norming, where everybody now reorients to the group. And then perform. You've got a group that can actually behave as a group. They no longer assert themselves. You know, we're all part of this together. So you've got a hierarchical, moves to a frustration level. Then it goes to regression. I've regressed to the group because I can't stand the frustration. And then I move on to group cohesion. And just in way of passing, that's why I have to control the environment. Because if I don't control the environment, I will relapse to the old way. Remember? I got to change the environment. I can change the people, but I also have to control the environment. So that's why I go to a TQM, Total Quality Management System, where it makes you, you cannot deviate from this system. And if you notice, this also conforms to Kurt Lewin. I unfreeze this group, I move them to a new level, and I refreeze them at the new level. Okay, so this is stuff straight out of Frankfurt, Germany. Some more table of contents, communication and listening, what is a facilitator, how to construct meetings, group dynamics. This is just one more comparison on the left, basic facilitation skills for law enforcement. I've got a list here. Initiating, building, information seeking, information giving. These are all the group roles that different people have. And on the right, I have, it's just a comparison of the group task roles from human relations and curriculum change. They're all the same. The initiator, contributor, the information seeker, the opinion giver, the information giver, the opinion giver. Human relations is on the right, and basic facilitation skills is on the left. These are the negative group roles. You've got the aggressor role. He's the guy that just doesn't want to cooperate with what's going on. He wants to assert himself. The guy that says, hey, well, look, I'm a contractor. I know how to fix that roof. Well, you're dominating this thing. Will you just please shut up and we can get on it? You're just an aggressor. The blocker, the recognition seeker, the self-confessor, the dominator. You know, these are all capitalist roles. These are people that hold to their position. These are all God's positions as well. Negative. The help seeker, you know, he just wants to, you know, special interest pleader, that sort of thing. Okay, they label these individual roles negatively. Those are just individuals. They don't know how to play in the group. And in basic facilitation for law enforcement, it's self-centered behaviors. So it's all the same stuff. This is just straight, it's just straight right out of human relations and curriculum change, the National Training Lab's Kurt Lewin's material. In fact, in the middle of this is force field analysis, based on the concept of Kurt Lewin. Two quotes from Robert Trujanowicz. I told you this is the guy that is considered the father of community policing. He said this in The Meaning of Community and Community Policing. Social control, we have to have social control, is most effective at the individual level. I agree with that. The personal conscience is the key element in ensuring self-control, refraining from deviant behavior even when it can be easily perpetrated. So in other words, if everybody in the community has got a conscience and they go by that business with an unlocked door and there's no one else around, the conscience will keep that person from committing a crime. So, and I read this, and I'm, oh, this is good stuff. I agree with this guy. Remember, this is a social psychologist. He was never a cop. Doesn't know anything about real police work. This is all social psychology. And we worship these guys. The family, the next most important unit affecting social control, is obviously instrumental in the initial formation of the conscience and the continued reinforcement of the values that encourage law-abiding behavior. I couldn't agree more. Now, the conscience is the most important part of having social stability, is it not? And the formation of the conscience is dependent upon the family. Conscience and family. Speak in my language. I don't have a problem with that. Oh, I think he's on my side, right? Unfortunately, because of the reduction of influence exerted by neighbors, the extended family, and even the family, social control is now often more dependent on external control than on internal self-control. He's saying it comes from one of two places: internal self-control or external control, right? And if I break down one, I got to have the other. Otherwise, I'm going to have chaos in society. He barely mourns the passing of the family and then goes right on into his community policing philosophy. He says, oh, well, family's dead. Next, it's the group. It's the community group that's important. You must have your conscience developed by the group. And of course, external control is a nice way of saying tyrants. External control. You better have those 100,000 new cops on the street. Because if you eliminate the conscience, you're going to have your Columbines and you're going to have your school shootings and stuff that were unheard of when the conscience was relatively intact in America, the individual conscience. We'll keep moving. If you just eliminate, just do that. Eliminate the conscience and the tyrant can take control. Eliminate the law, right, the internal law, who can rule? the lawless one. Ben Franklin, these guys knew their stuff. Only a virtuous people are capable of freedom. As nations become corrupt, they have more need of masters. He's saying the same thing. You know, Trudonowitz is saying nothing. These social psychologists think they're new and original and they're so insightful. These guys had it down 200 and something years ago. He said the very same thing. Virtuous people, you better have a conscience. James Madison, we have staked the whole future of American civilization not upon the power of government, external control. Far from it. We have staked the future of all of our political institutions upon the capacity of mankind for self-government, internal control. The same thing that Trudonowitz is explaining. Upon the capacity of each and all of us to govern ourselves, to control ourselves, to sustain ourselves according to the Ten Commandments of God. Wait, separation of church and state, they can't say that. They did. These are our founders. We have no government armed with power capable of contending with human passions unbridled by morality and religion. All those passions would break through the strongest cords of our constitutions as a whale goes through the net. Our Constitution was made for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate for the government of any other. Do you see? If I can just undo the conscience, ladies and gentlemen, just like what Benjamin Bloom said in here, opening Pandora's box, the affective domain, if I let people follow their id, if I let people follow their feelings, I can destroy your country. These guys warned us. I don't know why, what happened. We don't teach this stuff in schools anymore. Or not as much. Well, what does the Lord think of the imagination? What does he think of all of this stuff, all this sorcery? He says, the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination, the essence of sorcery, was of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. This process, ladies and gentlemen, is why God flooded the earth. This is why he rained fire on Sodom and Gomorrah. That's why he confused the language at Babel. Because this process, what did Nimrod do? He got people together. They had community. They had community at the tower. Let us build a tower and a city. In what? In defiance of God. Can you defy God? I don't know. Can you defy God? Can you get away with it? Maybe in your imagination, it seems to be you can. Scripture had this all laid out early. In 1 Samuel, he says, for rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. You've heard this verse before. What was Saul doing? He was instructed to go do something. He came back and he just didn't do quite all of it. Just a little. He did a lot of it, but not all of it. And Samuel came to him and says, how come you didn't finish the job? He says, well, you know, I did it. He rationalized his decision. I did some good things too. You know, I kept some of these animals so I could worship God. Yeah, that's not so bad, is it? And Samuel turned to him and says, you're a rebel. And rebellion is as the sin of witchcraft. What did he do? What did Saul do? He crossed the boundary. He went into the realm of can be and ought to be. I ought to be able to do what I want to do. That's witchcraft. I didn't make it up. The Word of God says it. And stubbornness is the iniquity of idolatry. The sun, the moon, and the stars. Insubordination. If you are insubordinate to a higher authority. This is the structure of social psychology. Because thou hast rejected the word of the Lord, what is? You've rejected what is. He hath also rejected thee from being king. God will reject this country. Given enough time. God is not tolerant. He's patient, but he's not tolerant. And Saul, she says, hey, you know, I've messed up. Hey, but because I feared the people and obeyed their voice, he feared man rather than fearing God. Simple. You see the process? Saul did the process. Eve did the process. Saul went right through it and then tried to justify his actions. Samuel said unto Saul, I will not return with thee, for thou hast rejected the word of God, and the Lord has rejected thee from being king over Israel. And then he turned to go, and of course Saul grabbed his robe and it tore, and he said, in like manner, God has torn you from being king over Israel. And Saul still persisted and said, look, please return with me. Worship with me. Why? He said, the strength of Israel will not lie nor repent, for he is not a man that he should repent. God doesn't change. He is. He doesn't modify. He doesn't evolve. He doesn't go through these cycles of changing. Then he said, I have sinned, yet honor me now. I pray thee before the elders of my people and before Israel, and turn again with me that I may worship the Lord thy God. He wanted an image in front of the people. He didn't want to be seen as being rejected by Samuel. So Samuel turned and went and worshiped with him. And finally, Psalms chapter 2. Why do the heathen rage and the people imagine a vain thing? Why do they imagine a vain thing? This is all vanity. It's just poetry. It's words. It's mysticism. It's sorcery. It's Baalism. Why do they imagine a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers take counsel together. They get together in Soviets. They get together in diverse groups. It says they conspire. People ask me, well, who's behind this, and what kind of a conspiracy is it? Well, the Lord tells you in the Psalms. He says this is a conspiracy. I mean, you want to know the names and the people involved? It's the kings of the earth. These people want global domination. And this is an anticipation of the day of the Lord. What do they say? And the rulers take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed, saying, let us break their bands asunder and cast their cords away from us. Walk out the door and show me what bands and what cords the Lord has around us. Where are they? Why are the kings of the earth saying this? Why are the peoples of the world so anxious to take counsel together and break the bonds? What bonds are we talking about? These. Those Ten Commandments. Those rules that restrain us. We can be our own God if we can get God and his rules out of our environment. They're imagining a vain thing. He that sitteth in the heavens shall laugh. He's not going anywhere. The Lord shall have them in derision. This process ends in chaos and confusion. We've fought two world wars over this. America had to go in there and bail them out. You have to wreck this. You know, once it gets critical mass, it's you're on for the ride. You can't undo it once it gets past a certain point. You cannot speak to the American people. They do not have a conscience. They do not have patriarchal language anymore. You talk to them, you go up and say, now be a good little girl or be a good little boy, they'll look at you with a blank. They don't know what that means. That has no meaning today. Hegel, thank you, created a dialectic world. He created a dialectic thinking process, and you cannot speak. The language is not there. Then he shall speak unto them in his wrath and vex them in his sore displeasure. That's the only way that he can speak to them anymore. Sodom, I can't talk to you. You're homosexual now. You can't hear me when I say, don't do it. They broke his cords asunder, and the only way he could speak to them was in his wrath, unfortunately. And what cords elsewhere, how does it describe the cords that he binds us with? He binds us with cords of love, doesn't he? Those are cords of love. The cannots are for our protection. Eve and Adam, please, don't eat of the tree. It's for your own good. I love you. Don't break the cords, because when you do, I have to judge you. You will die. He says, be wise now, therefore, O kings, and be instructed, ye judges of the earth. Serve the Lord with fear and rejoice with trembling. Serve. The solution to this is to repent, is to stop doing it. Turn. Who is God? Just bend a knee. Bend the knee. Acknowledge him. That's all he's asking for. Kiss the Son, lest he be angry, and ye perish from the way, when his wrath is kindled but a little. Blessed are all they that put their trust in him. Put your trust in him. Rest in him. Put on the whole armor of God. And having done all, stand. Stand in him. You have position in him. You have thesis in him. What sweet relief. You will not be a double-minded man. You will not have cognitive dissonance. You know who you are, and you know who's in control of the universe. Unfortunately, we're on for a bumpy ride. My intent here isn't to make you suspicious of your local police department, because they're not the only ones doing it. Every business is onto this. Every school, churches left and right have adopted this mentality and this thinking. You're going to hear from other presenters today that will detail those domains, those spheres that they are working in. All you can do is stand for the truth, stand in the Lord, and rest in him. That is your Sabbath rest, is to know that he is God.